Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
An innocent drug deal. A trap carefully laid. And a man who never walked out alive. In the bizarre story of Hoyt Burge, you'll follow the chilling chain of events from the moment Hoyt stepped into the house to the discovery of his body in a car trunk like discarded cargo. Who pulled the trigger? Who orchestrated it all behind the scenes? And why did his own friends turn into murderers? This isn't just a murder case, it's a brutal warning about betrayal, silence, and the thin line between good and evil. Don't miss it. Hit that subscribe button now to explore more gripping stories and unlock exclusive perks reserved for our loyal followers.
You're the first car that arrives there, correct?
Yes, sir.
You and Dee are sitting there, pulled into the driveway.
Yes, sir.
In a car that Mr. Briggs and any of the other occupants would not have recognized, agree?
I would assume.
Because you don't have frequent flyer miles over there, do you?
No.
You use those somewhere else?
Yes, sir.
Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, has long been known as a political and educational hub, home to the towering presence of Florida State University. Government buildings and academic halls stand side by side, painting a picture of order, calm, and intellectual prestige. But beneath this orderly facade lies a hidden current, a chaotic, unspoken underworld, the city's drug culture. A parallel world thrives quietly, where all-night parties and endless highs are a part of daily life. In neighborhoods scattered around the university campus, countless rental homes and duplex apartments, double as secret meeting spots where the lines blur between users, dealers, and addicts. Names like OxyContin, methamphetamine, and roxycodone aren't just medical terms. They're whispered in alleyways, traded from glove compartments, and discussed in hushed tones during casual hangouts. Transactions happen silently but steadily, ignoring the presence of police or the drug-free zone signs plastered across the streets. Deaths by overdose, violent turf scuffles, and unexpected drug busts are no longer rare occurrences in these parts. Yet what's even more alarming than the presence of drugs is the community's growing indifference to it all. People have learned to look the other way, or worse, accept it as an inevitable part of urban living. And then, in the early days of May 2017, under the bright Florida sun, a seemingly simple drug transaction took place inside a small duplex apartment just north of the university. No one suspected that what appeared to be a casual deal would explode into a nightmarish ambush, one that left a man dead, others behind bars, and a city forced to reckon with the darkness lurking in its own backyard. Hoyt Burge, 29 years old, was far from perfect. He carried the weight of a troubled past, multiple arrests for drug possession, evasive testimonies, and a lengthy rap sheet in the Florida justice system. But beneath that rough exterior was a man trying to change. To those who truly knew him, Hoyt wasn't just another addict. He had once been a good brother, a loyal friend, and at times, a man who showed genuine remorse. Before the incident, Hoyt was making efforts to rebuild his life. He had begun distancing himself from toxic relationships and staying away from places he once referred to as death traps. Lately, he had managed to stay sober long enough to hold down a few short-term jobs and attend his probation check-ins on time. He'd even started reconnecting with his mother, occasionally stopping by for dinner and listening, if only briefly, to the advice he used to ignore. But in a city like Tallahassee, where drugs creep through every alley and social circle, turning your life around is never simple. Friends from the past become temptations. Familiar places become dangerous hotspots. And sometimes, all it takes is one phone call, one innocent request to send someone spiraling back into darkness. Hoyt received such a call on the morning of May 8, 2017. It came from Paige, a woman who had once been a friend, occasionally a customer, and sometimes a go-between in past deals. She said she needed a few pills, nothing major, and asked if he could help. It wasn't the first time Hoyt had been asked for something like this, but something felt different. She was more insistent. Her voice had a nervous edge, and the location she mentioned, a duplex near the university, wasn't familiar to him. Despite the uneasy feeling in his gut, Hoyt agreed. Maybe he needed the money. Maybe he didn't want to burn a bridge. Or maybe, deep down, he still believed he could stay in control, that a quick drop-off wouldn't lead to trouble. But that one decision sent Hoyt Burge into a trap with no escape, where trust meant nothing. The past was unforgiven, and his hope of rebuilding a better life would be shattered by betrayal and the nearness of death. On the afternoon of May 8, 2017, the sun hung heavy over Tallahassee, casting its usual humid glow across the city. While students bustled around the busy campus of Florida State University, a quiet meeting was being arranged just north of the school at a small duplex on Mission Road. There, Paige Vowell was waiting with what seemed like an innocent request, a few prescription painkillers. She had reached out to an old acquaintance, Hoyt Burge, asking him to help her find some blues, a drug he had once easily sourced through old contacts in the scene. Hoyt didn't come alone. He brought along two friends, and the three of them parked their car just outside the duplex. They thought it would be a quick stop, make the drop, collect the cash, and leave. None of them carried weapons. None of them seemed nervous. It was meant to be a routine exchange between familiar faces, nothing to raise alarm. But inside the duplex, a very different plan had already been set in motion. Paige hadn't simply called Hoyt for pills. Her boyfriend, Briggs, along with a few close friends, had quietly organized a setup. Fueled by rumors that Hoyt had once plotted to rob them, they decided to strike first. Guns had already been loaded. A heavy hammer was hidden in the bedroom. Each person had been assigned a position the house staged like a trap, ready to spring. No one inside that home intended for things to end with a simple threat. When Hoyt stepped through the doorway, he may have sensed that something felt off, but by then, it was too late. The door shut behind him, and within minutes, the quiet residential street would erupt with screams, gunfire, and unimaginable chaos, the beginning of a tragedy no one could have predicted, born from what appeared to be a simple meeting. That fateful morning began with a brief string of text messages. Paige Vowell, a young woman with a serious addiction to prescription painkillers and murky ties to various dealers, reached out to Hoyt Burge. Her tone in the messages was light, casual, but something about it felt carefully calculated. She asked if Hoyt had anything, referring to a few OxyContin or Roxycodone pills, drugs widely sought after in her circle. Hoyt, who had been trying to stay out of trouble, hesitated. But Paige didn't back off. She followed up, saying, "Someone needs it badly, and money won't be a problem." No one knows the exact moment Hoyt agreed, but within minutes, he began preparing for the meetup. He messaged back that he'd try to pull something together and meet her that afternoon. For someone like Hoyt, used to fast deals and vague promises, it didn't seem out of the ordinary. But for Paige, his reply was the final piece of a trap she and her boyfriend, Paige Briggs, had been constructing for days. In the days leading up to this, Briggs had grown suspicious that Hoyt was planning to rob him. Some messages between Hoyt and an old acquaintance, Michael Cooper, had raised red flags. Briggs didn't call the police. He didn't issue a warning. He decided to handle it himself. And Paige was the perfect bait to lure Hoyt exactly where he needed him. Paige pretended she needed pills, but the real goal was to give Hoyt a reason to walk into the duplex where Briggs and his crew were waiting. Every detail was planned. The time, early afternoon when fewer people would notice, the location, a familiar spot where Paige had hosted Hoyt before, and the wording of the messages friendly, familiar, and disarming.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change, max 1 offer per account.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Once Hoyt agreed, Paige quickly reported back to Briggs. The others were summoned to the house. One brought a gun, another a hammer, and everyone was told to stay calm until Hoyt stepped inside. One member of the group, Patrick Bahrain, even arrived with an AK-47 hidden in an old backpack. Inside that house, they sat silently, waiting like predators crouched for the perfect strike. Hoyt, meanwhile, had no idea that the people who once smoked with him, laughed with him, and shared late nights just weeks earlier were now planning to take his life. He believed it was just another drug exchange. Risky, maybe, but manageable. He didn't bring a weapon. He didn't call anyone to watch his back. He had no reason to suspect he was walking into a trap. One simple call. One seemingly innocent request. That's all it took to lure a man trying to get his life back on track into a place where everything had already been arranged to end it. And tragically, it was someone he trusted who opened that door. Peter, Pete Tournay, wasn't a stranger to shady deals. He'd sold prescription painkillers before, had a few run-ins with drugs, and for years was known on the streets by the nickname Crackhead Pete. But at the time of the incident, Pete was just a guy trying to make a few bucks off the pills he had in his pocket, not to get rich, just to survive another day. That afternoon, Pete had 10 OxyContin pills, street-named Blues, and he planned to sell them to someone Hoyt Burge was bringing. The plan was simple. Hoyt would connect him to the buyer, Pete would make the sale, they'd split the money and go their separate ways. They'd done deals like this before. They trusted each other. No one suspected that this seemingly routine exchange would become the beginning of an irreversible tragedy. Hoyt was the one who invited Pete to come along, saying a girl named Paige needed something and that it was an easy score. Pete didn't know Paige, but if Hoyt vouched for the deal, it felt safe enough. Pete grabbed the pills, got in his car, and the two of them headed to a duplex on Mission Road, the very place that had been staged as a trap. When they arrived, Pete stayed behind the wheel, parked near the entrance. He didn't get out right away, wanting to feel things out before stepping inside. Hoyt, more comfortable, got out first and walked up to the door to speak with Paige. They exchanged a few words, and then Paige invited both men in. Pete hesitated, but trusting Hoyt and the familiarity of the moment, he followed his friend inside. The door closed behind them. There were no friendly greetings, no small talk. What Pete didn't know was that four armed men were hiding inside the home, and their target was Hoyt. Before Pete could react, chaos erupted. Yelling filled the room. Orders were shouted to get on the floor. An AK-47 appeared from the shadows. A hammer was raised as a threat. In an instant, Pete dropped to the floor, hands above his head, doing whatever he could to stay alive. He didn't dare look around. He didn't dare resist any pleas he might have had caught in his throat. In the minutes that followed, Pete had no idea he was witnessing the final moments of his friend's life. He didn't realize the punches, the beatings, the gunshots, they were all meant for Hoyt. All he knew was that he had led his friend into that house, that his presence had helped complete a plan he knew nothing about. Pete Tournay wasn't a good man, but that day he hadn't meant to hurt anyone. And the price he would carry, the lifelong guilt of unknowingly leading someone to their death, might weigh heavier than any sentence a courtroom could deliver. Inside the small duplex tucked away on Mission Road, Paige Vowell and her boyfriend, also named Paige Briggs, were quietly finalizing the last steps of a violent plan. They didn't call the police. They didn't seek legal protection. They decided to handle what they saw as a threat, Hoyt Burge, on their own. Days earlier, Briggs had come across Facebook messages between Hoyt and a man named Michael Cooper. The content was vague, but it was enough to spark fear and anger. Briggs believed Hoyt might be planning to rob him. Briggs wasn't unfamiliar with violence. He had a history of drug dealing, a criminal record.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
And a mindset always teetering on paranoia. But this time, instead of retreating, he chose to strike first. The group was called back to the house, a collection of addicts, small-time dealers, and a few unpredictable wildcards, people who didn't need a reason to act, just an opportunity. In the bedroom, a worn black backpack sat waiting inside, were an AK-47, multiple handguns, and a carpenter's hammer. The weapons weren't just tools of intimidation, they were symbols of power. And that night, Briggs and his group wanted it known. They were in control. Patrick Bahrain, one of Briggs's closest allies, was the one carrying the AK-47. He was rough, quiet, and always first to act when things spiraled. The hammer was given to another member, a backup in case the guns weren't enough. Everyone had a role. One in the bedroom. Two behind curtains. One seated near the living room, a pistol ready in hand. Paige the Bait kept her composure. She texted with Hoyt casually, trying to sound natural. Meanwhile, inside the house, the others checked their weapons, shut windows, dimmed the lights, and cleaned up anything that might look suspicious. Everything was being staged like a scene in a dark play, one destined to end in blood. According to their initial claims, the plan wasn't to kill Hoyt. The goal, they said, was to send a message to scare him, to show he couldn't cross them without consequences. But when weapons are placed in the hands of people high on methamphetamine, the line between threat and murder becomes dangerously thin. And then, all that remained was to wait. Wait for the name to appear on the phone, signaling Hoyt's arrival. Wait for the knock on the door. Wait for the moment it would swing open, unleashing all the rage, fear, and addiction into an explosion of violence no one could stop. Rarely mentioned in the official case files, but according to a witness living near the area, the deeper reason behind Briggs' violent actions stemmed from a long-standing tension between him and Hoyt Burge. On the surface, they had mutual ties, occasional drug deals, shared circles, and overlapping party scenes. But beneath that facade was a simmering mix of distrust, resentment, and fear. Briggs had confided in close friends that he felt unsafe whenever Hoyt was around. A few months prior, during a deal gone sour, Hoyt reportedly lost his temper when the price changed at the last minute. He shouted, damaged property inside Briggs' home, and issued a chilling threat. "You screw me again, I'll come back and take everything you have." Briggs wasn't the kind of man to forget a threat like that. Ever since, he had shown visible signs of anxiety whenever Hoyt's name came up. He kept his distance, limited communication, and remained on high alert around anyone tied to him. Conversations among his inner circle began circling a single question. What do we do if Hoyt comes back? Then in May, when Paige told Briggs she had contacted Hoyt to ask about buying pills, Briggs reacted immediately. To him, this wasn't a typical transaction, it was an opening, or more precisely, a threat that needed to be neutralized before things spiraled out of control. From Briggs' perspective, the ambush wasn't an act of aggression, it was self-defense. He didn't hide this during questioning. "I just wanted to make sure he never came back," Briggs said. "I wasn't trying to kill him. I just wanted to teach him a lesson." But that so-called lesson was delivered with a hammer, with firearms, and with blood. Part of what made Briggs so aggressive was a past trauma years earlier. He had been robbed in that very same apartment, and he'd lived in a hyper-defensive state ever since. When you combine deep-rooted fear with methamphetamine-fueled paranoia, the line between self-preservation and revenge begins to blur. There were even rumors in the local scene that Hoyt had ties to a larger drug network, one that Briggs truly feared. But Hoyt was the only one who showed up, and that made him the target. Briggs allegedly told a friend, "I can't wait for him to make the first move. If I don't act, he'll kill me first." This element, though not emphasized in the formal indictment, reveals the mindset behind Briggs' preemptive retaliation. A man haunted by fear, marked by threats, and consumed by the belief he was being hunted, chose the only path he thought could protect him. But that choice cost a life, and nothing could undo that. The moment Hoyt Burge stepped across the threshold of the Mission Road duplex, the air inside the home seemed to freeze. It was a silence, not born from welcome, but from tension, a silence weighted with menace. Behind him, the door slowly swung shut. A second later, the sound of the lock clicking into place cut through the stillness like a death knell. Hoyt was unarmed. He wasn't alert. According to one witness, his face carried a hint of ease, maybe even a smile. He still believed this was just a quick drug exchange. What he didn't know was that he had just walked into a room thick with premeditated violence. The apartment was eerily quiet. The lights in the living room were dim, and no sounds filled the space except for his own cautious footsteps. Within seconds, four men burst from hidden corners like shadows coming to life. One held a handgun, another gripped a hammer, and the third, Patrick Bahrain, pulled an AK-47 from a black backpack. Each of them had their roles. Their target was clear, and they were all focused on Hoyt. He barely had time to react. A voice shouted, "Get on the ground!" But Hoyt stood frozen, confused. His eyes locked onto Patrick, who was now aiming a rifle straight at his chest. Pete Tournay, who had entered with Hoyt, immediately dropped to the floor, hands raised, too terrified to even look up. According to later testimony, Hoyt began to step backward, his hands partially raised in a defensive gesture. But no one gave him a chance to speak. Another shout, "Don't move!" Then a fist slammed into his face, sending him stumbling. Blows followed rapidly from fists, from gun butts, and from the carpenter's hammer they'd stashed away earlier. Hoyt tried to defend himself, but the pain quickly overwhelmed him. He cried out, "What's going on?" But there was no answer, only another kick to the chest. He collapsed, clutching his head, trying to shield himself. But the beating didn't stop. One by one, they took turns unleashing whatever rage they had stored within. The door behind him remained locked. No one outside could hear the chaos. No one inside had any intention of stopping. And in the center of it all, Hoyt Burge, a man with a troubled past, but a desire to start over became the helpless target of a plan he never saw coming. The groans, the stomping footsteps, and the sounds of weapons striking flesh echoed through that small apartment, the brutal opening act to a tragedy sealed the moment that door locked shut. Barely 10 seconds after the door locked, four armed men stormed out from the back of the duplex like shadows erupting from the dark. Their heavy footsteps pounded against the wooden floor, echoing like war drums. In their hands, handguns, a carpenter's hammer, and the unmistakable shape of an AK-47, a weapon so menacing, Its very presence was enough to freeze blood. Pete Tornay, who had entered with Hoyt, instantly panicked. Without hesitation, he dropped flat onto the floor, hands behind his head, stammering, "I don't know anything. Please don't shoot." He didn't try to run. He didn't try to defend Hoyt. In that split second, pure survival instinct overpowered any sense of loyalty or friendship. Hoyt Burge, on the other hand, didn't go down easily. Shocked and stunned, yes, but not helpless, he remained on his feet, reacting with the instincts of someone who'd lived around danger for far too long. He spun around, scanning for an exit, hoping for even a sliver of escape, but every route was blocked. His attackers had accounted for everything. One of them shouted, "Get on the ground! You're dead if you move!" But Hoyt didn't listen. Maybe he thought they were bluffing. Maybe he believed he still had a chance. Or maybe, deep down, he knew that going down now meant never getting back up again. He lunged toward the front door, but a blow to his shoulder knocked him sideways. Another man kicked him hard in the back. Despite the pain, Hoyt fought back, shoving one of them, trying to push through. For a moment, the room froze. No one had expected resistance. His defiance didn't last long, but it was enough to throw everything off balance. A hammer swung past Hoyt's head, missing by inches. A gun was suddenly pointed straight at him. Patrick shouted, "Hold him down! He's reaching for something!" Instantly, the others rushed in. They tackled him, shouting, flailing. Amid the chaos, someone screamed that Hoyt was pulling a weapon, even though he was completely unarmed. That single accusation triggered everything. A gunshot rang out sharp, final, unforgiving. Silence fell over the room like a curtain. Pete lay still on the floor, face pressed to the wood, eyes clenched shut. Hoyt was motionless, blood beginning to seep through his shirt. No one moved. The air hung thick with dread, the smell of sweat, smoke, and something irreversible. The hammer clattered to the ground. Breath came in ragged gasps. In the center of it all was the aftermath of a decision that could never be undone. Hoyt Burge staggered, but he didn't fall. Though he had already been knocked down once, he pushed himself upright in the chaos, refusing to give in. His face was bruised and swelling. Blood dripped from his nose and mouth, but his eyes had not surrendered. This was no longer about escaping. It was a final, instinctive fight for survival. Just as Hoyt managed to get to his feet, a hammer swung from behind and crashed down on his shoulder. The metallic thud against bone echoed through the tight room. He dropped to one knee, clutching the injury, but still didn't go down completely. Instantly, a powerful punch struck him in the face, followed by a brutal kick to the ribs that sent him stumbling back into the wall. The room had turned into a space of unchecked violence. All reason and restraint had been discarded. Patrick Bahrain, the one holding the AK-47, hadn't joined the beating, but his eyes never left Hoyt. As Hoyt tried to crawl along the wall, searching desperately for some exit, Patrick stepped closer, slowly raising the rifle. The distance between them was less than 2 meters. Their eyes locked. Hoyt, breathing hard, leaned against the wall, his left hand raised in a weak, defensive gesture. From behind, Paige screamed, "Stop! He doesn't have anything!" But no one heard her, or perhaps no one cared to listen. Patrick clenched his jaw, lips pressed tight, finger tightening on the trigger. The gunshot shattered the room. A single shot, cold and deliberate, struck Hoyt squarely in the chest. His body jolted violently, as if pulled back by an invisible force, then crumpled to the ground. No one spoke. No one moved. Pete Tornay remained face down on the floor, barely breathing. The entire room was swallowed by a haunting silence, not of peace, but of irreversible consequence. Blood began to pool from the wound, spreading across the floor like dark ink. Hoyt lay on his side, eyes wide open, lips trembling as if trying to say something, but no sound came out. No one stepped forward to help. Everyone stood still, as if the shot had frozen them in place. Patrick held the rifle, hands slightly trembling. No one in that room had truly expected it to go this far, but once the trigger was pulled, there was no turning back. In that moment, time seemed to stop. And within those stained walls in what had once been just a run-down apartment lay the scene of a cold-blooded killing. It began with a trap, escalated into rage, and ended with a bullet fired at point-blank range. In the initial official reports, Paige Vowell was portrayed simply as the bait, the one who sent the texts, who invited Hoyt to the duplex where her boyfriend's group was lying in wait. But a detail omitted from the public case files revealed a deeper layer to the crime, a personal motive that pushed Paige to participate in the murder plot. She had been harassed by Hoyt during a previous drug transaction. According to unofficial testimony from one of Paige's close friends, the incident occurred about 2 months before the killing. Paige had met with Hoyt to buy pills, something they had done several times before. But that time was different. Alone in a dimly lit room, during what should have been a routine deal, Hoyt unexpectedly moved on her inappropriately. He didn't physically assault her, but the crude comments, threatening stares, and invasive closeness left Paige shaken. She managed to get away unharmed, but the experience never really left her. Paige never went to the police. In the world of street-level drug trade, women like her rarely found protection in the law. She chose silence, but the memory stayed like a hidden wound, and when Briggs began suspecting that Hoyt might be plotting to rob him, Paige didn't need much convincing to go along with the plan. In her eyes, luring Hoyt in wasn't just helping her boyfriend, it was a chance to confront the fear she had been carrying ever since. In the days leading up to the incident, Paige remained calm. She texted Hoyt as if nothing had ever happened. But according to one group member's statement, it was Paige who first suggested roughing him up. When Patrick hesitated, it was Paige who said, "You don't know what he did to me." This detail drastically recontextualizes the ambush. It wasn't merely about preemptive defense or a personal feud between Briggs and Hoyt. It had the flavor of revenge. Paige wasn't just a manipulated pawn. She had her own reasons, her own scars, and her own need for justice, however twisted. When the gunshot rang out, Paige may have felt the world slow down. In that instant, the memory of that night, the harassment, the fear may have come flooding back, but not as pain, as closure. In the silence that followed the blast, she didn't scream. She didn't panic. She stood motionless, watching Hoyt collapse to the floor, blood spreading beneath him, and said nothing. Though Paige would later deny having any personal motive, the off-the-record testimonies, the knowing looks from those close to her, and her chilling silence as she stood in that blood-soaked room, they spoke volumes. This wasn't just a killing born of suspicion. It was a calculated release of rage. And Paige wasn't just a part of it. She was at the center of the storm. The room fell into a frozen stillness after the gunshot. No one moved. The echo of the round still rang in their ears. Hoyt's body lay motionless, cooling rapidly, his blood spreading in a dark, thick pool across the wooden floor. What was once a living man had become a symbol of rage, paranoia, and a mistake that couldn't be undone. Patrick Bahrain, who had pulled the trigger, stood frozen, the AK-47 still gripped in his hands, his eyes wide, his fingers trembling. He said nothing. Paige Briggs, who had witnessed the entire scene unfold, stepped back against the wall, her stare blank. One by one, the others dropped their weapons to the floor, as if only then realizing what had just happened. There were no screams, no crying. Every emotion had been swallowed, replaced by a haunting silence, the kind that only follows death. Then, like some automatic reflex, Patrick opened a cabinet under the sink and pulled out a small bag of meth. He placed it on the table, lit a glass pipe, and inhaled deeply. No one objected. One by one, they followed, trying to smoke away the reality they had created. They sat in a loose circle in the living room, just feet from Hoyt's corpse. No one dared look at the body, but no one left either. Minutes passed before the first voice spoke. "What do we do now?" Another replied quickly. "Call the cops?" Only to be shot down immediately. "If they come, we're all going to prison." Paige finally spoke, her voice raspy. "No one says anything. We need another plan." Panic set in like a slow-moving disease. One person suggested dumping the body in the woods. Another talked about burning it in the backyard. But no one actually moved. They were paralyzed by fear and by the weight of what they'd just done. Then came a knock at the door. Everyone jumped. They scattered, moving instinctively. Patrick gripped his weapon tighter. Pete Tournay, still lying on the ground, lifted his head, terror all over his face. But it wasn't the police. It was Jesse Fox, a casual acquaintance, someone Paige had invited earlier to join the party. The moment Jesse stepped inside, he sensed something was wrong. He froze in the doorway, scanning the room until his eyes landed on Hoyt's lifeless body. "What the hell is this?" he asked. No one answered. Patrick approached him, laid a hand on his shoulder, and said quietly but firmly, "Sit down. Just listen." Jesse turned to leave, but Paige blocked the way. "You know now. You can't walk away. It wasn't a threat. It was reality." Jesse was now part of the scene. He hadn't pulled a trigger. He hadn't known the plan. But his presence complicated everything. Patrick offered a deal. "Help us move the body. That's it. Then you can go." Jesse didn't reply. But when Patrick dragged out a plastic tarp from the back room, Jesse stepped forward, silent. Jaw clenched. He helped lay it flat on the floor. No one spoke of guilt. No one spoke of right or wrong. All that mattered now was covering the mess. They wrapped Hoyt's body tightly in the tarp, sealing the ends with duct tape. Someone threw an old jacket over his head. Every movement was mechanical, like cleaning up after a party, except this time, what they were hiding was a human life. Pete had finally stood, but he said nothing. He leaned against the wall, eyes locked on the bundle that now held the corpse of his friend. His mind was blank. He hadn't fired a shot, but he had brought Hoyt here. He couldn't rewind time. And now, there was no way out. The bundle was dragged out the back door and loaded into the trunk of an old Toyota Camry parked outside. Jesse drove. Patrick sat in the passenger seat. Paige and another followed in a second car. Their destination: a remote parking lot miles away where they hoped to dump the body long enough to figure out what to do next. That night, Tallahassee remained quiet, peaceful, even. But within its calm facade, a group of young people had crossed a line, one they would never return from. And from that moment on, none of their lives would ever be the same. The sound of duct tape ripping echoed through the house like a desperate cry. On the floor, Hoyt Burge's body was being wrapped tightly in a gray plastic tarp, the kind used to cover roofs or line construction sites. Each fold sealed away another trace of humanity. His body, once living and breathing, had become nothing more than a burden to hide in the eyes of those who once called themselves his friends. Patrick Bahrain took charge of the task. He issued sharp, curt instructions that no one dared challenge. Jesse, Fox, and another member carefully rolled the body, while Paige Briggs held the tape, wrapping it around the edges again and again until there were no openings left. No one spoke. They avoided eye contact, as if silence could somehow reduce the weight of their guilt. The room still reeked of blood, meth, smoke, and the pungent sweat of panic. Pete Tournay stood in a corner, arms limp at his sides, his face pale as chalk. He didn't help with the wrapping, but his eyes stayed locked on every movement. It was the look of someone who had just lost something irreplaceable: trust, conscience, maybe even his soul. Once the last strip of tape was in place, the group paused for a moment. They stared at the package in the center of the room, crude, lifeless, with no sign it once held a person. Patrick shrugged. It's done. Get it to the car. The silver Toyota Camry was already backed into the rear driveway, hidden from street view. Jesse popped the trunk. It was spacious enough to fit the bundled corpse. The group lifted the tarp, avoiding the head, and quickly placed it inside. The trunk slammed shut with a hard, final thud, like a punctuation mark ending a life. Paige turned away, biting back whatever emotions were rising. Patrick wiped the sweat from his brow with his sleeve, then scanned the area, checking if any neighbors were watching. No lights flickered on. No sounds came from nearby homes. The Tallahassee night remained eerily quiet, too quiet. Inside the trunk, Hoyt's body lay still, swallowed by darkness, pressed between cold metal walls. A man who once breathed, once dreamed, who had tried to rebuild his life, now reduced to a problem to deal with. To them, it was over, but it wasn't. They didn't know that from this moment forward, every step they took, every trace they left behind, would be followed. The Camry, rolling silently into the night, carried more than a corpse. It carried the weight of truth. And soon, it would become the key piece of evidence that would bring everything crashing down. Pete Tournay stood against the wall, sweat dripping down his forehead, his hands trembling uncontrollably. No one had directly threatened him yet, but the look in Patrick Bahrain's eyes was enough to unravel any sense of safety. It wasn't the look of someone who had just killed in panic. It was cold, calculating the gaze of someone clinging to control through sheer menace. Pete knew that if he didn't act quickly, the next body in the trunk could be his. As Patrick returned from the back of the house, after checking around the car, Pete stepped forward cautiously. He kept his distance, but his voice had changed no longer, cocky, now low and desperate. I still have drugs, he stammered. Patrick turned to him, raising an eyebrow. What? I mean, I can give you everything I have left, all of it. I won't keep a single pill. If you let me go, Pete said, his eyes fixed on the floor. He knew he didn't hold much value in that room except for one thing the others always craved: drugs. Patrick was silent for a few seconds. The tension in the room was razor sharp. Jesse, standing nearby, averted his gaze, wanting no part of this conversation. Paige said nothing, her eyes dry, distant as if she'd already detached from the reality unfolding around her. You trying to buy your life with pills? Patrick asked, his tone unreadable. Pete nodded quickly. I won't say a word, ever. Just let me walk. I'll hand over everything I've got. They stood in silence, Pete's heart pounding in his ears. Then, without a word, Patrick gave a small nod, gesturing with his hand. Go get it. Then get the hell out. If I see you again, I won't warn you. Pete backed away, then bolted for his car. He didn't wait. He didn't speak another word. In his back pocket were a few leftover pills, a small stash that had suddenly become his only ticket to survival. Even though he made it out of that house, Pete knew he wasn't free. He couldn't escape what he'd just seen. And those few pills, the same thing that had once kept him alive, had now marked the point where everything shattered into a tragedy that could never be undone. After handing over the remaining pills and being granted permission to leave, Pete Tournay didn't waste a single second. He ran straight to his car, hands trembling as he jammed the key into the ignition. The engine sputtered to life sluggishly, almost mocking his panic. As the tires rolled away from the back lot of the duplex, Pete never looked back. He knew if he did, he'd fall apart. The drive to his mother's house took just over 10 minutes, but to Pete, It felt like an endless nightmare. He drove like a ghost, eyes bloodshot, body shaking. He nearly veered off the road more than once. His mind was still trapped inside that apartment where his friend had just been murdered, where he had lain face down on the floor, helpless as the violence unfolded in front of him. When he reached the rundown house where his mother lived, Pete didn't knock. He pounded on the door, shouting, "Mom, open the door, please!" His voice was hoarse, trembling with panic. His mother, used to seeing her son come home in bad shape, open the door with tired eyes. But this time, she didn't need to ask what happened. One look was enough. Something terrible had just occurred. Pete collapsed to the floor, covering his face with his hands. His words came in gasps, jumbled, repeating the same phrase over and over. "I saw it. I couldn't stop it. They killed him, Mom." His tears flowed freely, his voice breaking like a child. His mother didn't understand the full story, but she could feel the weight of what he carried. She guided him to the living room, handed him a glass of water, and quietly reached for the phone. Within minutes, she had a dispatcher on the line. "I need to speak with the police. My son just witnessed a murder." She gave the address. Pete sat motionless, hands clenched tightly together, as if trying to hold on to whatever fragments of sanity he had left. When the police arrived, Pete didn't run. He stepped outside, raised his hands in the air, and said in a gravelly voice, "I'll tell you everything. I just want this to end." With that sentence, the first domino fell, and the truth about what happened inside the small duplex on Mission Road began to unravel, piece by piece. Just hours after the call from Pete Tornay's mother, the Tallahassee police began their search. Though Pete's statements were scattered and laced with panic, they were enough to outline a chilling picture. A murder had taken place in a duplex near the university, and the victim's body had been hidden in the trunk of a car. That same night, patrol units were dispatched to sweep nearby parking lots, matching Pete's description. Around 2 a.m., officers located a silver Toyota Camry at the U Club student housing complex. The vehicle was parked awkwardly and sloppily, covered with an old tarp. The front plate was missing, and the overall setup looked hastily abandoned. The officers proceeded to inspect the vehicle. As they opened the trunk, a foul stench immediately escaped. Inside, they found a large object wrapped tightly in plastic sheeting secure, but not enough to fool seasoned investigators. As they peeled the layers away, the sight confirmed Pete's claims. A man's body, bound in tarp and duct tape, dried blood visible, with bruises and a gunshot wound clearly marking a violent end. The victim was quickly identified as Hoyt Burge, a man with a known history of drug-related charges, though he hadn't been in recent legal trouble. In his wallet were his ID, some cash, and a slip of paper with an address, the same address Pete had given investigators. The entire parking area was immediately sealed off. Forensics teams were called in. They collected fingerprints, blood samples, and potential evidence from the car. Nearby, security cameras were reviewed, and it didn't take long to spot footage of a group arriving at the lot around 10 p.m. the night before. Among them was Jesse Fox, now a person of interest. Hoyt's body was transported to the coroner's office for a full autopsy. Preliminary findings confirmed the cause of death: a single bullet wound to the heart at close range. Additional trauma indicated that Hoyt had been severely beaten before being shot. With clear physical evidence now in hand, Pete Tornay's testimony gained serious credibility. Within hours of the car's discovery, a crime that had been buried in the shadows was thrust into the spotlight of the entire city of Tallahassee. A manhunt was underway, and for those involved in Hoyt Burge's death, there would be nowhere left to hide. Less than 24 hours after Hoyt Burge's body was discovered in the trunk of the Camry, Tallahassee police had compiled a full list of suspects, all based on Pete Tournay's detailed statement. Their first target, Patrick Bahrain, the man who pulled the trigger. Through phone records and tips from acquaintances, investigators tracked Patrick to his girlfriend's house in the southern suburbs of the city, around 5 p.m. The following day, a tactical team surrounded the residence. There was no chase, no resistance. Patrick opened the door in silence, fully aware that his escape was over. Dried blood still stained his clothes, and inside his backpack, officers found the AK-47 damning evidence that left no room for denial. With Patrick in custody, the investigation moved quickly. Using the names Pete had provided, police began locating and arresting the rest of the group. Paige Briggs was picked up at a temporary apartment on the city's west side, where she was staying with a friend and pretending to have no knowledge of the crime. But it only took a few questions from detectives for the fear to surface in her eyes. Jesse Fox, who had helped dispose of the body, didn't stay hidden for long either. He was arrested on his way to a bus station, apparently trying to leave the state. Officers found a backpack containing blood-stained clothing and a partially used roll of duct tape. One by one, the remaining group members were tracked down and taken into custody over the next 3 days. Each arrest was supported by Pete's testimony, combined with phone data, surveillance footage, and physical evidence from the crime scene. By the fourth day, everyone involved in Hoyt Burge's death had been apprehended and officially charged. What had once seemed like a tightly guarded plan to commit murder and erase the traces had unraveled, completely brought down by fear, mistakes, and one witness who couldn't live with the silence. The courtroom was packed that morning. Cold fluorescent lights cast a harsh glow over the heavy silence that gripped the room. The victim's family sat in the front row, eyes red and locked on every moment. On the witness stand stood Paige Briggs, no longer proud, no longer cold-eyed, like she had been during the early interrogations. Now she was thin, shoulders slumped, voice hoarse, and her eyes held something deeper than fear. She told everything from the first phone call luring Hoyt to the duplex to the moment his body was loaded into the car trunk. Paige's testimony wasn't just a clinical timeline of events. It was soaked in emotional conflict. She admitted she was the one who planned the contact, the one who knew exactly what was going to happen and did nothing to stop it. "I didn't say anything because part of me wanted it to happen," she said, her gaze fixed straight ahead, not daring to meet anyone's eyes. The physical evidence backed her words completely. The text messages between her and Hoyt, the bloodstains in the apartment, the surveillance footage from the U-Club parking lot, all of it created a picture that was undeniable. But it was Paige's and Jesse Fox's testimonies that illuminated each individual's role in the killing. Patrick Bahrain was identified as the executioner. He raised the gun, pulled the trigger, and ended Hoyt's life with a single shot to the chest. Jesse confirmed this, adding that he was called only after the murder, though he admitted helping to hide the body. The person at the center, the one who connected all the dots and pushed the violence forward, was Paige. She didn't pull the trigger, but she was the link between Hoyt and his killers, the one who opened the door that led him straight into an ambush. Pete Tournay, the sole survivor and whistleblower, was also called to testify. He sat shaking as he faced the others across the courtroom. His voice cracked when he spoke of his friend. "I didn't think it would go that far. But when I saw the gun, I knew no one would survive if I stayed silent." By then, the courtroom was no longer just a place of legal procedure. It had become a psychological dissection, each truth dropped like a stone in dead air, each witness forced to face what they had tried to bury. This wasn't just a case about bullets, blood, and a body. It was about silent complicity, shattered friendships, and a plan that bound them all together until it exploded. On the day of sentencing, the courtroom was silent. The space, once filled with heated arguments and shifting voices, now felt heavy so still that one could hear the sound of people breathing, hearts pounding. The judge read the sentences in a steady, detached tone, as if justice required a cold, unwavering hand. Paige Briggs, who had lured Hoyt into the trap, was sentenced to 35 years in prison. She didn't react. Her eyes stayed on the floor. Not a single tear fell. Maybe she had cried enough already. Maybe the weight of her guilt had long since formed a prison in her mind long before the court assigned her a number. Briggs Page's boyfriend, and the one who helped plan the ambush, received the harshest sentence, 40 years behind bars for conspiracy to commit murder, illegal firearm use, and body disposal. As he was led out of the courtroom, he looked back once toward Hoyt's family, but no one returned the glance. Patrick Bahrain, the man who pulled the trigger, was sentenced to 38 years. His defense attorney tried to argue diminished capacity due to drug influence and group pressure.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull, Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern. Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
But the judge dismissed it. A man who fires point blank cannot claim coercion, the judge said, and with that, any hope of leniency vanished. Among all the defendants, only one was granted a full acquittal, Vicky Strickland. She had shown up at the apartment after the murder, unaware of the plan and uninvolved in the cover-up. Her innocence was supported by both evidence and witness testimony. When the judge announced her acquittal, Vicky broke down in tears as if she'd been holding her breath for days, waiting for this moment. When the proceedings ended, there was no applause, no smiles. The guilty left the room in handcuffs. The grieving remained seated, weighed down by a sorrow that sentencing couldn't resolve. Justice had been served, but no one walked out of that courtroom untouched. Everyone carried their own version of a sentence. No one expected Pete Tornay to survive that case, not just physically, but emotionally. When the trial ended, while the other defendants were led away in handcuffs, Pete walked out on shaky legs, silent. He wasn't prosecuted, but he couldn't exactly call himself free either. What he carried out of that courtroom wasn't relief. It was a sentence of a different kind, one written in memories of death, silence, and a single last chance to choose what was right. Just a week after the verdict, Pete checked himself into a rehab center in Gainesville. No one pushed him to go. He cut off contact with old friends, severed ties to anything that might pull him back. The first days of detox were hell, his body convulsed, his mind torn between guilt and emptiness, but he didn't quit. He knew that if he went back, there wouldn't be another chance. There wouldn't be another day to wake up. 4 months later, Pete walked out of that center, a different man. Thinner, older, but with eyes no longer clouded, he got a job at a local community center. Eventually, he began helping lead recovery meetings, using his own story as a warning. Pete never claimed to be a hero. He always said just one thing. I'm living proof that one decision can either destroy or save a life. And in every talk, he spoke of Hoyt, not to justify himself, but to remember. To remember a friend who died at the hands of people he once trusted. To remember how close he came to letting it all happen without a word. On the line between guilt and redemption, Pete had once stood right in the middle, and in the end, chose to step toward the light, not to be forgiven, but to never betray what he had seen again. And in that choice, more than any punishment, he salvaged what was left of his soul.